Please be seated. Good morning.
Good morning.
The first case on the panel's oral argument docket this morning is the Town Center Drive and 215 LLC versus Bank of America, case number 60672. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
All right. Good morning. Please proceed, Mr. Hill.
Good morning, distinguished justices. Thank you for taking this time to consider this case. I'm Tisha Black of Black and the Bellow, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant Town Center. The reason we are here today is to determine whether this court is going to protect the borrower's right to cure as the legislature intended. In the majority of non-judicial foreclosures, the lender and the borrower agree on the documents germane to the foreclosure, the enforceability of those documents, and the amounts due and owing that are derived from those documents. In those cases where the borrower and the lender have an accord on these issues, there is no need for judicial intervention. The foreclosure can take place if the borrower does not exercise its right to cure. However, in those rare occasions, when the borrower and the lender don't agree on the foreclosure documents or amounts, or where a party has not acted in compliance with the statute, the legislature demands that the foreclosure be returned to the oversight of the court to determine the contested matters related to the foreclosure and compliance with the statute. This is mandated by the legislature in order to protect the borrower's rights. The statute we are discussing is NRS 107.080. This statute is not overly complex. Although it has consistently drawn the attention of the Nevada legislature in the last three sessions, 107.080 is the non-judicial foreclosure statute wherein the legislature has prescribed the rights of the borrower and the obligation of the beneficiaries and the trustees in a non-judicial foreclosure. The mandatory provisions applicable to the issues on this case in this statute are 107.080.2, 3, 5, and 7. Section 2 states that the power of sale must not be exercised if written notice of the amount of default, the principal amount of the debt secured by the deed of trust, interest, late charges, and fees are not disclosed in writing to the borrower. Section 3 states the power of sale must not be exercised if the amounts in Section 2 are timely paid. This section is the right to cure section. Remember, this statute, this non-judicial foreclosure statute, was enacted under the premise that the parties to the foreclosure would not only agree but would comply with the statute, otherwise the takings of one's property must be administered by the court. That is why we have Section 5, which states, a sale made pursuant to the statute must be declared void if a party to the foreclosure does not comply. All of these mandatory provisions were put in place by the legislature to assure the fair treatment and protection of borrowers' rights. Finally, Section 7, which became effective in October of 2011, states that if the trustee or beneficiary did not comply with any requirements under Sections 2, 3, or 4, the court must grant to the borrower an injunction enjoining the power of sale until they comply with Section 2, 3, or 4.
Now that you've kind of walked us through the law, walk us through this as it pertains to the facts in this particular case, as to the situation that you're asserting in light of the transactions and the loan transactions that have occurred in this case.
Thank you for the question. Here, Bank of Nevada asserted its right to foreclose by commencing the non-judicial foreclosure process. They listed, concurrent with subsection 2 and 107, the amounts that they believe are necessary to cure the loan. Those amounts are derived from essentially three documents. The first document is the construction deed of trust, which was executed in 2005 for $12.2 million. $12,200,000, excuse me. The second was an extension of that deed of trust for another grant of a loan under the construction deed, a note, for an additional amount, which brought the loan to $14 million. So the first two adjustments were for loans that the borrower received. The third was related to a derivative. And importantly, under this derivative, the borrower contests the enforceability of the derivative, and therefore it contests the appropriateness of the amount stated in the NOD. Section 7 of the statute relates to just this issue. When a borrower brings or raises the issue to the court that the amount set forth in the cure provision are incorrect, the court must enjoin the foreclosure in order to protect the borrower's rights and in order to protect the cure provisions that the legislature intended for borrowers to have. Here, the issue is that at the lower court, the district court judge said first, she made a ruling with regard to that derivative, and she said first that the derivative in regards to the foreclosure is not related to the property. That's erroneous, because the derivative is secured by the property in the same exact fashion that the note was secured by the property, pursuant to a deed of trust that's recorded in the real property catastrophe of this county. So if the court is going to hold that the derivative is not related to the property, then it follows that neither can the note be related to the property, which is an absurd result. Then there would be no foreclosure.
Wasn't there a resolution of the amount owed under the derivative where your client borrowed the money necessary to address a portion of the Treasury Lock agreement?
There was no resolution, Your Honor. There was merely an accommodation at all times during this derivative.
But when the $1.7 million came due, you paid $600 and borrowed $1.1 million or $1.2 million, isn't that true?
No, we never borrowed $1.1 million or $1.2 million. The bank rolled it back into the property and secured it with the construction deed of trust. At all times, the borrower contested the derivative. And it's important to note...
Even when that transaction occurred?
At all times, the borrower stated, I can't understand why I have to pay this. I don't understand this instrument. He was completely misunderstood about the enticement to enter into the instrument.
But let's back up. Didn't the moving party, didn't the party on this have something done by one of the other members explaining this transaction to them before they entered into it?
The borrower relied on the bank's representations of the derivative.
Wasn't there an in-house memorandum that was done just by your CFO or something of that nature?
Yes, Your Honor, there was by Mr.
Dean. As to that?
And in response to that memorandum, Mr. Dean specifically asked the specialized unit out of Orange County relating to derivatives whether or not the derivative would be a bet against interest rate. And the response was not purchasing the derivative or not entering into the derivative, excuse me, would be a gamble. So the borrower was never knew of this instrument. The borrower had a 35-year history of working with this bank on interest rate locks. The bank solicited this borrower to enter into this complex transaction. The borrower never understood it. I submit to the bank, at least Joanne Tallarico and the members of the bank here never understood it. And certainly, Justice Gonzalez at the lower court, having admitted to reading the derivative herself, consented that she didn't understand it either. So what we're seeking to do here is merely maintain the status quo by keeping in line with the legislative intent, keeping the injunction in place and allowing the borrower to go back down the road and to get fact-finding so that they can determine the circumstances and issues surrounding the derivative. The borrower has maintained its position that they should be able to assert its rights and defenses to the derivative contract prior to the foreclosure occurring. judicial process is meant for straightforward residential and commercial transactions, such as a simple note and a deed of trust. It's not meant for a speed to foreclosure action, and it's not meant for a complex commercial transaction made more complex by forcing the sale of a derivative on a borrower in suspicious circumstances, wrought with duress, at a time when the banks were notorious for having acted in a less than honorable fashion. The borrower isn't asking for the moon here. The borrower isn't even asking for any new law to be made. We really want this court to uphold the plain language of the statute and the borrower's rights for a fair and legal foreclosure. Without such a ruling, the statute will become meaningless. The borrower is requesting that this court reverse the decision of the lower court. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Before you sit down, I'd like to ask an additional question. It's my understanding that Mr. Black testified that when the Treasury Lock agreement came due, testified during the preliminary hearing, Town Center met with representatives from Bank of America and came up with a plan to settle. Town Center would pay some money and Bank of America would increase the construction loan amount to cover the remainder of the amount owed. This is at 12, Appendix 2586.
Yes, sir.
Is that right?
It is right. However, there's a few salient facts that are missing from that snip of the statement, which are that at all times Bank of America had promised the borrower that they would place the borrower in a permanent loan situation. So in reliance on Bank of America's promises that the borrower would receive a permanent loan.
There is a site in the record where you find that, because that is one of the things that, at least from the initial review, at least from the lower court's position, was the bank never promised them a permanent loan. So I'd ask if you can supply where in the record we can find that.
That's when, let me remind the court that we're not here after we've had...
Well, you've made the statement, so I'm just asking where it comes from.
The statement comes from what I know to be true from the borrower.
Where in the record can we find that, since you're asserting the statement? That's what I'm asking.
Would have to be in the testimony of Mr. Black, which I could provide to the court, but it wasn't. It's not a quote that was provided in the brief.
That's fine. We have looked at his testimony. I don't know that there is any record or testimony that we've seen where he indicates Bank of America committed to provide a permanent loan. Do you have any document or any testimony from a representative of Bank of America
In addition to the promise to pay that we're discussing right now, the bank also stated that the derivative would be a far superior instrument to a standard rate lock, which it in fact wasn't.
But the judge indicated that this issue was susceptible to monetary damages, contractual relief, which wouldn't justify an injunction. Your response to that is Section 11 compels it.
My response to that is that what the judge indicated was, as you said, monetary relief for the taking of property is an adequate remedy. And I could cite a state, a list of case law relating to that premise as being incorrect. The judge state that if, because the derivative is a part of the property, because it was secured by the property, any amounts related to the derivative that are claimed in the foreclosure are inappropriate. If the judge didn't believe that the derivative was secured by the property, the judge should have extended her statements by saying that Bank of America must go back and restate the amounts put in the notice of default to exclude the amounts related to the derivative. That complies with the clear plain language of the statute.
The one other question I had for you and for counsel for the bank, the treasury lock agreement indicates that it's secured. Does the deed of trust that secures the loans recite the fact that it also secures the treasury lock agreement?
Yes, sir, it does.
All right, thank you. We'll add 2 minutes to your time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Mr. Stein?
Good morning, Justice. My name is Michael Stein. I represent Bank of America. We ask that this court affirm the district court's ruling to deny the preliminary injunction. The appellant says that this case is about a borrower's right to cure, but nowhere in the record can that be found. That was not presented to the lower court. This case is actually about whether or not the district court abused its discretion in denying a motion for a preliminary injunction.
We don't dispute that sections 2 and 3 of the statute compel a correct statement of the outstanding principal balance that's due.
That's correct. It does.
And isn't that principal balance in dispute?
It is not.
Not?
The I think you correctly stated there was $14 million owed under the underlying note for the construction, and there was another $1.1 million that was financed to pay off a separate debt. That debt was not secured. You asked that question, it was not. It was not secured because there was no security agreement. It was just a contract. And there was a date certain to settle that contract based upon the terms of the contract that was extended twice at the request of Town Center.
So the $1.1 million was not added to the promissory note secured by the deed of trust?
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly what happened. So the construction loan, or the note, was secured by the deed of trust. The treasury product, the derivative, had no security. It was paid off. That contract is over. It was paid. Now, the word settlement is used in two different manners here. One is by the terms of the contract. It's called a settlement when the settlement date comes, and one of the two parties has to pay each other. And on the date that it came due without any further extension, the way the treasury rates worked, the interest rates had gone down.
Mr. Sandler, I asked a specific question of Ms. Black. I asked the same of you. My understanding is that the treasury lock agreement contained language that indicated that it was secured. But did the deed of trust, the construction deeds of trust, recite the treasury lock agreement as an instrument that it was securing?
No, it did not. No, and I did see that in the briefings, and we'll address that now.
Okay.
That language used in the brief to support the contention that this treasury lock was anticipated, this derivative product was anticipated, was parsed. It was parsed. The operative language missing, where it said that this covers swap agreements, which is what I think you're referring to. The operative language says, related to this loan, capital L, and this loan in that same part of the trust defined as the original loan for the $12.1 million. So the appellants come to this court suggesting that that derivative, when it was entered into, was secured by that deed of trust. And they parsed the language to get there, leaving out the operative language with respect to. I want to tell the court where that can be found to make it a little bit easier for the court when we go back to review this. That section is the language is in connection with the loan, with the loan being defined as the original loan to finance the purchase and construction of the property. The claim that the derivative was tied to the underlying loan can be found on page 4 and 9 of the reply brief. But the derivative wasn't tied to the underlying loan. This, as I said, was parsed language. It was merely a hedge against permanent interest rates in the future for any loan that Town Center may have gotten, if any. Because I would like the court to understand something. Even if Farm Center had sold the property right before the derivative settlement date, and the interest rates had gone up, Bank of America would still have had to pay. Even if there was no permanent loan for anybody in the marketplace to give Town Center because it sold the property, it still had to pay. And that was clearly articulated in the derivative product and in the marketing materials. Just as it's an onerous standard that Town Center bears when it seeks to appeal a denial of a permanent injunction, because if the district court's findings are supported by the substantial evidence, they should be upheld. In this case, the district court not only had a lot of briefings, all on the merits before it even had this permanent injunction hearing. Judge McGee had a very long hearing and oral argument on whether to grant the receivership that was applied for, which is what this case started as from Bank of America's perspective. Judge Scan came back from the Judicial College and heard it again and ruled that the receiver was appropriate. Then Judge Gonzalez had the opportunity to hear a three-day trial on the issue of a permanent injunction. And she really had to look at two main factors, the likelihood of success on the merits and whether there was irreparable harm. So I turn first to the likelihood of success on the merits. Judge Gonzalez dismissed all of that one claim of breach of good faith and fair dealing. Now that doesn't mean because she felt it had merit. She didn't dismiss it because under Rule 8, it at least pled a claim. And what is that claim pledging that breach of that covenant? That Town Center was promised permanent financing by Bank of America. Well, the difference between the motion to dismiss and the permanent injunction hearing are facts. The presentation of facts. So once the judge had 3 days to hear facts from the salient witnesses, Mr. Black, his CFO, one of his main contacts at B of A here on the ground in Las Vegas involved in making this loan, and a member of the bank who took over the loan upon the default. After 3 days of trial, the likelihood of success comes down to an interesting question asked by the judge, even though I asked it on cross-examination. The judge asked Mr. Black, did anybody promise you a permanent loan from Bank of America? He said no. Under oath, Mr. Dean was asked the same question. She asked that question three or four different ways. And each time they said no. You asked the appellant, where in the record can you point to in which there's evidence that's admissible that there was a promise? And the answer is from counsel is, that's what I understood. Well, in the briefing before the court, that's the same thing that counsel wrote in the brief that they signed. They cited that statement that there was permanent financing, but the citation to the brief was to their own closing argument, not to any facts. The facts before the court and the district court were that there was no permanent financing offered by the bank. One, there was no writing of it. Two, the derivative product that came long after the loan specifically provided that one of us has to pay the other whether there's a loan or not. And that makes sense. Because what's happening is that the Town Center is getting the benefit of hedging the possibility of rising interest rates. It wins both ways, although Mr. Black said on the stand that he felt he lost because he had to pay. But would he have felt he lost under the same exact contract if interest rates had gone down and the bank had to pay? When the derivative was first taken, the testimony from Mr. Dean was an acknowledgement that interest rates were going up. And an acknowledgement that at any time they could pull the cord, they didn't have to wait till the settlement date, they could have said stop and got a check. But they didn't. They waited and interest rates started going down. But they believed then it might go back up again. So they extended it another time, and then another time, but the interest rates kept going down. And so there came a time when suddenly it came to settle, and they could have extended it again if the bank would have agreed, but they didn't. They realized interest rates were going down, and they had to pay. They got the benefit of their bargain. The bargain was a stabilization of interest rates. Had the interest rates gone down as they did, they would have been entitled to pay the money, but they could offset that knowing that the interest rates were lower. Had the interest rates gone up, they would have got a cash payment from Bank of America. That payment would have approximated what Town Center thought would have been their increase from the time they wanted to set an interest rate lock, essentially, to cover that rise. So either way, they actually benefited because they got certainty or they minimized risk. So if they got the cash payment, it wasn't like a windfall. It wasn't like, oh, we did get something. Because interest rates were higher, they'd be paying more money. Because interest rates were lower, they paid less money in interest, but they hedged against the possibility of a rate hike. So with the issue of likelihood of success, all claims were dismissed by the court. So the likelihood of success from the district court standpoint was very low. And they bring up about, well, we could have amended. But they weren't really clear in the briefs about what that meant. The district court told them, with respect to your fraud case, I'll let you amend as long as you're claiming some sort of fraud outside of the derivative contract. In other words, if you can bring me some fraud regarding the underlying loan, then maybe, you know, I'll stop this foreclosure. Well, they had 3 days to do that and brought no evidence regarding fraud when it was a loan. The only evidence that came out is that Bank of America really worked with this investor, giving 5 modifications to the loan. The first two had to do with an increase in the loan from $12 million to $14 million. Was the first. The second was to finance the portion of the derivative that Town Center couldn't pay. They worked with them. They would have been in breach of contract, but they worked with them and financed it. The next two extended the time of the construction loan. And the last one, the fifth modification, simply provided that Bank of America could sweep accounts set aside from any rental incomes so that they could pay down their loan. The other dealt with this fiduciary issue. Judge Gonzalez stated that if you can bring evidence of a special relationship as contemplated under Perry v. Jordan, the Nevada Supreme Court case governing that, then you can amend. Well, again, when it came time for the preliminary injunction hearing, they could provide no evidence. The evidence that they found that the judge was presented with and that she made a ruling on was that this was an incredibly sophisticated businessman who had admitted to hundreds of millions of dollars in transactions, had built many, many office buildings and complexes and condominiums, was the chief executive officer of a casino. He was a sophisticated businessman with a sophisticated team. He had Mr. Scott Dean, his CFO, and a certified public accountant. That certified public accountant provided a memo, as you mentioned earlier, telling Mr. Black exactly how his derivative product would work, and warning him. If you look at the memo, he writes in all caps, in a font size much bigger than the rest of the memo, if interest rates go down, you will be paying Bank of America. He made it crystal clear what could happen, warning him, this is how it works. And they still went forward with the derivative. I mentioned earlier that I'll just touch on this on the irreparable injury now with that. There is no irreparable injury. If they could prevail on their breach of good faith and fair dealing claim, they would get money damages for the $1.7 million.
Is the analysis, Mr. Steen, of irreparable injury change, given the legislature's language in, I think it's Section 11, added in 2011, that compels the district court to grant a preliminary injunction where the principal amount is in dispute or has not been correctly stated in the notice of default and election to sell?
Well, there was no dispute in this case about the dollar amount. There was no dispute that the $1.1 million was borrowed, and there was no dispute that that it was put into the loan. The issue, therefore, was whether or not there was a claim for the breach of good faith and fair dealing, which the court at the time of the motion to dismiss said that's a properly pled case, but at the time of the hearing, where they had the opportunity to establish this breach, they didn't. And at a preliminary injunction hearing, you have to put on your case, and you have to prevail and show a likely success on the claim. And the judge found you didn't, because there's no evidence that you were promised permanent financing. In fact, the evidence from the appellant's own manager and CFO was that they weren't promised it.
So, but as I understand it, there are two separate questions. One has to do with whether there was a promise for a permanent financing, and the second question has to do with whether there was a breach of good faith and fair dealing, a claim that's still alive in the case, surrounding the Treasury lock agreement itself. That question has yet to be tried.
Well, that is true. It has not been tried, but at a preliminary injunction hearing, that's your only claim. And you have to prove a likelihood of success on that claim. And the judge found they did not, because the good faith and fair dealing...
That takes you full circle, though, to the question that I asked. Does the analysis of preliminary injunction, does the standard that is normally set for preliminary injunction, requiring a showing of irreparable injury, change when there's a statutory mandate from the legislature that a failure to comply with the correct statement of the balance owed requires the district court to issue an injunction nonetheless?
I don't believe so, because you still have the likelihood of success in the merits component of our system for injunction relief is incorporated into that. So you have your day in court to show your likelihood of success on this claim. Otherwise, it would simply require a statement from every borrower, I was misled, and you would have an injunction, if it was read that way, on every single place blocking every single non-judicial foreclosure until a full trial. Even though if it was read in that way, you could have a preliminary injunction hearing in which the borrower has the opportunity to show a likelihood of success on the merits. They only have to win. They just have to show a likelihood of success on the merits. And they couldn't muster that, because the sole basis of their breach of good faith claim is that I was promised permanent financing. That's the sole basis. And they stated themselves, I was not.
Okay. Your time has elapsed. Are there any questions from my colleagues? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Ms. Black, as a threshold question, what is the amount that you contend was misstated in the notice of default and election to sell?
Any amount that is associated with the derivative, and any amounts that is associated with interest on the derivative. Those amounts, to expound upon the question that you asked Mr. Stein, yes, Section 11 of the statute states in clear and plain terms that if the court has determined that the amounts set forth in the NOD are incorrect, they must enjoin. There's no discussion in that language about thresholds.
But I don't see that argument being made to the district court.
We did make it at the district court in about 20 seconds at the very end, when she said that she found know that when she stated that she did not find that the derivative was related to the property, then we stated, then the amounts stated in the notice of default are incorrect. The statute...
But did you specify an amount, or was that by argument or by testimony?
That was by argument. And the reason for that is, Your Honor, because that we have never agreed with Bank of America.
I don't think you had that in your papers, though, opposing the preliminary injunction, did you? Did you say in your papers, opposing the preliminary injunction?
We said early in court, we said this. Okay. We discussed the matter. So much of what was happening at the preliminary injunction was a first impression because we haven't had the opportunity to conduct any formal, methodical, or organized fact-finding. Mm-hmm. There's been no evidence. There's been no opportunity to do that. And importantly, the court did say that we have an argument of good faith and fair dealing that remains with the derivative. And if we prevail on that, argument and the many of arguments that are destined to come when we get into discovery in relation to Bank of America's actions with regard to the derivative and this borrower, and any of those amounts are found to be, any of the amounts pled as the cure amount are found to be incorrect or inappropriate because the derivative isn't enforceable, then the borrower has lost its cure right. Because those amounts are set forth in the notice of default at this point. So on the one hand, if the court says that the derivative is not related to the property, then she must mandate that the Bank of America go back and extract those amounts from the derivative so that we can argue about those amounts and have a right to cure. That's all we're asking for, is to maintain the status quo to address those issues.
All right. Do my colleagues have any questions? Thank you, Ms. Black. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate your input on this matter, and it will stand submitted.